At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Today on The Grave Talks, Ghosts of World War II. Who are the ghosts of World War II? World War II, of course, is one of the most defining times of the last century. Countless lives lost, families destroyed, mental sanity pushed beyond its limits. With so much mental anguish expelled in such a short period of time, is it any wonder that the areas physically affected by this point in history remain a hotbed for paranormal activity? Are there still soldier spirits out there, unaware that the war has ended? Or are these ghosts of World War II, seen by the living today, simply a residual display and replay of this horrific time in human history? Today on The Grave Talks, we're going to talk with Matthew L. Swaney, author of the book Haunted World War II, about the ghosts of World War II.
Well, it's a bit of a long story that I have to take back to birth, because okay. I was born on Halloween. So that's what really kicked off this whole kind of side career for me. So basically, I was born on Halloween. I loved ghost stories. I loved, monster movies and everything throughout, ever since I could remember. But one thing that happened to me was I became a journalist. And every year I would try to come up with a decent Halloween feature story. And one year I decided to do local ghost legends. And I'm from a town called Tyrone, Pennsylvania. It's in central PA. And so I started just kind of looking around for ghost lore and ghost stories. And I got some local ghost stories. And I actually work at Penn State, and I lived near Penn State at the time. So I found some ghost stories about university ghosts and haunted buildings at Penn State. So I added that to the story. And what I really wasn't expecting was the reaction that I got, I would say, of all the stories that I wrote during that, 5-year period at the local newspaper. That was probably one of my most popular. And I was a little amazed at how people would come off the street or in a restaurant, in a bar, and start telling me their ghost story. And so something kind of clicked with me. And I thought, I like the subject matter. I like to write. I'm going to start collecting these stories. And that's really what I've done for the past 10 years, is collect stories and compile them and put them into different volumes. This one in particular, I wrote a book about university ghost stories, and then I did 2 books on rock and roll ghost stories, one on country music ghost stories. And I was looking around for something else to kind of connect what I like to write about and what I like to research. And I really like military history. I have a minor in history, so I originally thought I would write a volume of Civil War ghost stories because I'm a Civil War buff. But what I found out was that territory has been so well written about, and I didn't think I could really bring anything or add anything to it. So I just decided I would start looking at whether there were whether this phenomena of ghost stories and tales of haunting and Fortean occurrences also carried over to World War II, and I found out that indeed it did.
Now, when you started jumping into investigating ghost stories of World War II, where did you think it was going to lead you? Were you just planning on this would just be stuff that, you know, people had come back and they've taken things with them? Were you planning that, oh, this is going to end up taking stories, you know, overseas? What was kind of in your mind at the beginning there?
Yeah, that is a really great question, because I really followed the model of some of the Civil War ghost books that I like and I read, which was mainly battlefield ghosts. So mm-hmm. I started out basically thinking that, well, Battle of the Bulge, Normandy, the Eastern Front, all of those areas, I started to check out those stories first. But what I found is that World War II is really the first actual global conflict. So you had battlefields all around the world. You had, you know, there are haunted battlefields in Okinawa, in Iwo Jima, and it's also in the places where I assume there were going to be ghost stories, like Russia and also Normandy. But the other thing that I really wasn't counting on is, as I got deeper, is not only are we talking about a land conflict, we're also talking about a sea conflict. So that started to raise questions in my own mind. I wonder if there are any haunted battleships. And of course, I heard stories earlier about some of these ghost ships that were brought back and now serve as museums. So I started investigating that. And sure enough, there were lots of ghost stories that based on ships and warships, battleships, aircraft carriers that were in the war itself. The other thing that I was fairly weirded out about was that World War II also has this third dimensional aspect of it, because there were planes in the air. And so I knew about Foo Fighters, but what I didn't know is that there are actually ghost planes. And these are not, you know, ghosts in a plane, but the plane itself is a spectral entity that people have seen, or at least have claimed to have witnessed. So that was the general way I approached it. It started out just looking at land battles, but then I added on to it. And I should add that this is one of the first books I've written where I've also looked at some of these Fortean occurrences, like synchronicities. And I looked into what I called the magical battle of World War II, where different occult powers on different sides were kind of waging war against each other. So it was almost like a spiritual battle, too. So it ended up being, as far as I'm concerned, a lot more interesting for me, and a lot more involved and a lot more broad and deep than had I gone for that Civil War book.
Sure. Tell me about when you started investigating this stuff, who were the type of people that were sharing their ghost stories with you?
Well, I usually go towards written accounts. So I'm basically compiling accounts. And as a journalist, I know that once you enter your story in print, it does give you a little bit of credibility. So I do look at blogs, newspapers, magazines, other books. And then I started to reach out to ghost hunters, because they always give me some good stories. Plus, you know, I think that they become pretty credible sources, too. The other thing I should add is that I also look at these stories as ghost lore, which is a manifestation of folklore that involves ghosts. So some of the stories, I would say, are actually this kind of ghost lore, that these ghost stories morph into ghost lore that surround these areas. So that's another kind of aspect that I look for, and mainly those stories you'll find in books about it, or local papers, magazines, etc.
And I want to talk about several of the topics that have been focused on several of the chapters that you talk about in the book. Before I get there, though, another question I had about just kind of the curation of this book and putting it together. When you had some of these stories put together about some locations that are still visitable, that are still in existence or what have you, did you ever have any conversations with any of the vets, you know, from that time that experienced World War II and fought in it firsthand? Did you ever hear any stories directly from them? Because I know historically, and just, you know, speaking, that's usually not necessarily ghosts, but just speaking of what happened during the war is sometimes a difficult thing for a lot of them to talk about, with, you know, very, very understandably.
Right. So that certainly plays a role in it, I'm sure. The second thing is that the number of World War II vets, as I was doing this book, had dwindled down to just a few.
Sure.
You know, so I didn't have a chance to reach out to them. What I did find was that the vets didn't have as many stories as the tourists, as the people who visit these sites, as the residents who live there, the vacationers. That's where most of these stories seem to pop up.
Okay.
You know, I guess at the time, maybe some of these World War II vets were experienced some World War I ghost stories, but not from World War II.
Sure.
You know, I did add some stories in there about General Patton's encounter with the ghost of his ancestors in World War I. Some of those stories did crop up. But no, I didn't have a chance to actually sit down with any World War II vets. You know, now that I remember that I did my probably second most popular story when I worked at the paper was the 50th anniversary of D-Day. And I talked to a lot of vets there. That would have been a perfect opportunity for me to see if they had any of these encounters.
It's one of those things where it's, you know, unfortunately, as time passes and as so many of them, as we lose them, you look back going, huh, I wish I had some of this information then to ask them some of those questions.
Right.
Let's start talking about some of the chapters in the book, some of the things that that you learned about. Mm-hmm. Let's start out with you know, some of the ones that I know you had noted about the USS Lexington, and the seemingly that there's a ghost on there from that time that appears to want to be employed and give tours. Let's talk about that.
Right. Yeah. So the USS Lexington was now its kind of supernatural history starts right away because it was nicknamed the Blue Ghost. And the Japanese soldiers and sailors named it the Blue Ghost because they had thought they sunk it. And all of a sudden the Lexington was back and it would pop up in the most bizarre fashion. So that's how it got the nickname the Blue Ghost. Now, the ghost stories happened as they brought back the Lexington back to the United States, and it serves as a museum boat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a matter of fact, you can take tours of it. And according to one family, one group of witnesses, they said that, you know, they went on to take a tour. And they noticed right away that the tour guide was in uniform, like in a naval uniform. And I'm sure they had questions about that because usually they're not in this naval uniform. But this tour guide took them on a tour of the boat and showed them all the different parts of the ship. And then they also described him as being blonde-haired and blue-eyed. And they said that eventually he just vanished, and they asked some other people, you know, who was this great tour guide? What a great tour it was. Turns out they had nobody under that description as a tour guide. And the other thing is there's a raft of other stories about that where people have seen this blonde-haired, blue-eyed sailor on the Lexington, and that's given rise to this notion of the ghost of Charlie that haunts the USS Lexington.
We had a gentleman on the show, probably about 50 episodes back or so, who gives tours on the Lexington, and he gave us his accounts of all the ghost stories that are on that boat. And what's interesting to me about that boat is the fact that from his accounts, he said there's not anything negative on here. He said, I love, this is paraphrasing, but he loves being on there. He almost joked about becoming a ghost someday himself and haunting the boat. He loved it so much and being a part of it. And he always says that he felt like everything that's on there very much wants to be there and is not in any sort of dismay or sadness, but they're there and they seem to be doing what they want to be doing.
Yeah, I would. Well, first of all, maybe that'll give me a sequel if he does go back and haunts the Lexington. But also, I would say, especially with the ghosts that appear on this, the ships, they definitely seem to be more, not very negative. All of these seem to be more positive hauntings for the most part. I mean, I don't think I came across any ones where the witness was attacked. I do remember the one ghost hunter telling me that she was pinched, but you know, if you're on a ship with a bunch of sailors prior to the Me Too movement, you know that might happen.
Yeah, and I'm guessing they're probably operating more so in their time window of life more so than ours. So
yeah, I would guess
probably slightly unaware of the Me Too movement if they're
right.
If they're let's talk about some more of the locations that you've investigated. The full body apparition that appears over at the Schofield Barracks. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, and I guess I should back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the Schofield Barracks.
Yeah.
Because one of the most haunted places on American soil is, of course, the area around Pearl Harbor. A lot of people kind of conceive of the attack of Pearl Harbor just being localized at the harbor itself with the USS Arizona, et cetera. But in fact, there were a lot of other airfields, army bases around that were also attacked. And there were a lot of people, a lot of soldiers and sailors and air people who were in the Air Corps who were killed there too. Schofield is another one of those places, and I might be getting these stories confused, but Schofield, are you referring to the one with the woman who was in the she had been house sitting for her brother who was away at war? Is that the one?
I believe so.
Yeah, so this was this woman's brother had I think it was like offsite housing or off base housing, and she was asleep one night and fast asleep and heard some noises and woke up and someone burst into the room, and she claimed it was a full-bodied apparition, a person who was looked like dressed in World War II, who was ordering her out of the house. So there's a bit of back and forth about this ghost story because some people think that this wasn't a negative haunting. Others say that maybe the ghost was trying to warn her, maybe reliving some of those moments of on that December 7th attack.
When you have things like that and you have the almost like conscious type haunting where it's there to warn you, and it's like it's still in an element, it's in its own time, but in another it's there and it's fully participating in the world that we live in today, versus something that's just replaying itself over and over. How much of that did you find in your research when it comes to World War II ghosts? We're kind of generally speaking here. How much of it did you find to be more so conscious entities versus a residual something replaying very dramatic or very emotionally charged events over and over?
It seems to be more of the latter, more of the residual hauntings. I think I would say probably you know, 95% of those, there doesn't seem to be a lot of interaction, which gives rise to a lot of questions about, you know, the intensity of the conflict and how that registers in really on the consciousness of the witness, because they're prepared to experience something like that. So I think one of the stories that strikes me that is in line with that whole idea of the residual haunting was in Dieppe Beach. And according to this story, there was a family from England, and I think it was actually two families, and they decided they would vacation in Dieppe Beach. And Dieppe was the location of, I guess you'd call it almost like a practice invasion. A group of commandos, allied commandos, landed on the beach, and it was almost like a rehearsal for Normandy. A lot of people think that's the idea behind it. But it turned into a disaster. They were supposed to have coordinated airstrikes with the landing. That didn't happen. The Germans responded quickly and forcefully, and it turned into a lot of Allied casualties and a lot of lessons learned before they decided to invade Europe with the invasion of Normandy. And anyways, this family had camped out in this house that apparently used to be a base for the German commanders at the time. And this the invasion, I think the attack actually happened in late August, and this was early August, so the dates don't necessarily match up as like an anniversary. But the family was sleeping, and two of the women heard this horrible racket, which sounded like machine gun fire, people yelling and screaming, explosions. And instantly, these two women got up and ran to the door and went outside. And they couldn't see anything, even though they heard the noises. And then the noises somewhat subsided. They go back to bed, and about an hour or two later, they hear what sounds like planes and dive bombers strafing the area. They got up again, looked out, nothing. So when they got back to England, they went to the British Society for Psychical Research and reported this. And so the psychical researchers there decided to investigate. And what they found was that account matched up very almost exactly to the timeline of the invasion. So there was this land invasion, or rather, invasion on the beach. It was repulsed, and then the planes came over a little later, and that sort of matched up with the witnesses. So to your point, that to me sounds more like one of these residual type hauntings.
And when you have those residual type hauntings, and you have the dates, we were talking, you said the dates didn't seem to match up, but as far as the events itself go, as far as what happened in what order, mm-hmm. That to me, it's so interesting that these events occur. It doesn't even have to be matching up to the specific date. Do you think there's a reason why, or is there something that triggers these events to replay themselves, or at least the audio, or sometimes the visuals? You know, where we're able to re-see them, are they just always going on, do you think, and then we're just picking up on them? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's, you know, when I first started writing about this, I really approached it more as entertainment. I loved the stories. I liked ghost lore and folklore, and it was a lot of fun. But what happens is, after you've written about so many of these and you start, you know, contacting or reading these accounts of people who seem very, they seem normal, they seem believable. I'm a former reporter. I kind of get an instinct about this. You start coming up with your own speculations about this. And I consider myself an open-minded skeptic. I've never had anything happen to me of such power that some of these people have happened to them, that they believe and they're total believers. I still haven't had that encounter. And to be honest with you, I don't think I want to have it. But my point now over time has vacillated between, is it just something mental, or is there really, you know, these poor soldiers that are being forced to, their spirits are being forced to replay these actions over and over? I mean, are there real entities or something? But what I'm coming across from both this book and the books that I've written prior to this is that this seems to be more of what I would consider more about the consciousness of the witness rather than the consciousness of these spirits or ghosts. I think there is something, whether paranormally, normally, mythologically, or maybe all of the above, that are playing a role in these experiences. Because what I found too is that when I talk to people who have had these experiences, these are what I would consider almost spiritual encounters. These are people who've come up to something that they don't know about, that they can't explain through rational means, and the best way to tell them is through these stories. So I believe that this is not, you know, maybe something that is embedded in the natural environment, but really this is an interplay between the memory and the consciousness of the witnesses that gives rise to these encounters. That's kind of where I'm at now. But I'll tell you, as I write these things, I go back and forth on trying to really figure out what's going on. It's just a mystery to me.
Do you have more questions now than you do answers, as far as from when you began?
Absolutely. I could not put it better myself. I would never expect to. And the other fascinating part of this for me was that prior to this, when I wrote about the ghosts of World War II and country music ghosts, there was a fun aspect to it. I mean, Jim Morrison is haunting the bathroom of a Mexican restaurant. That to me is lighthearted, and you were able to use a little humor in the stories and a little asides. But when you get into the tales of World War II ghosts, they're very heavy. War is a very heavy emotional thing, and it's full of this kind of gravitas. And so now I feel like getting all these different points of view, feeling all these different ways that this puzzle fits together, I have less certainty about anything. When I started off, I would say I was more of a skeptic. And now I'm kind of in the middle, and I vacillate continually between those two points of view. I can write a story and say, oh, here's a natural explanation for this, and then I step back and the other side of me says, but if that happens, then this doesn't make sense. And so to me, it's really intriguing and really interesting, and that's one of the reasons why I keep putting these books together.
Have you come across, in the compilation of this book, being able to identify any of the spirits or ghosts that you're talking about in terms of who they actually were in the living?
Right. You know, not really. Mm-hmm. No. Some of the ghost stories that have filtered down, I mean, there's ones that are definitely ghost stories that you know who it is. There's the story of General Patton, who was in a Jeep crash and then perished later in the Army hospital. Both of his daughters, one daughter claimed that the phone rang in the middle of the night. She answered it, and they said, this is a long-distance call. Will you take it? And I don't know whether that was the exact words or whatever, but sure. It was basically an overseas call, and she took the call, and it was definitely her father's voice, who then faded away, and she lost connection. So she rang the operator back, and the operator said there was no call made. There was no overseas call made. At the same time, her other sister said that the ghost of her father, General Patton, appeared at her bedside while she was sleeping, and she knew it was him, and I think he even communicated with her. So this is a case, you know, first of all, that breaks the pattern of being a residual. That sounds more like an intelligent haunting. Mm-hmm. But also, you definitely know that that's General Patton. The other ghost stories that I found overall were much more anonymous, so that there was no certain soldier who was involved in the conflict, or a certain civilian in the case of some of the ghost stories overseas.
Except what I was getting to, and I was wondering, you know, when people are investigating stuff with this, with World War II, and obviously so many of the individuals we're talking about, you know, either if they perished during the war itself or if they perished afterwards, there's not a lot of them left to be talking to. But I'm curious about the family and what their thoughts are on some of these stories. If, yes, that sounds like Dad, that sounds like Mom or whoever, or my brother, you know, with some of the accounts of what they're doing or not doing. Mm-hmm. But clearly there's a good tie-in right there with Patton and the daughters getting that phone call and showing up at the side of the bed. What were some of the areas of this book that most surprised you as far as location of where paranormal activity is taking place in relation to World War II?
Yeah, that's the biggest surprise for me is one of the strategies I used was to think of all the famous generals and warriors that I studied about and see if I could search and find any of these ghost stories about them. And I had some American stories, Eisenhower, Patton. I looked into Churchill, and he pops up here and there as a ghost. And so I was trying to look for someone on the German side, someone that wasn't so heinous that I could add to the book. And so the one that I started to investigate was whether there are any ghost stories about General Erwin Rommel, who is called the Desert Fox. And so, you know, through search engines and Google, I'm looking everywhere. I figured, well, I would imagine the ghost of Field Marshal Rommel would be in North Africa, which is the site of most of his famous battles. And I couldn't find anything there. And so then I looked in Normandy, because I figured, you know, he was instrumental in designing the fortifications at the in Normandy and along France, all those, I think they the Atlantic Wall, they called it. So I looked there, and he didn't show up there either. And then I also tried to Google him and his ghost in Germany. That was not successful. The weirdest thing happened to me is I found ghost stories about Rommel in West Virginia, basically in the American South. And so I really couldn't figure that one out until I started to delve into that a little deeper. And the story goes that prior to World War II, right after World War I and before World War II, a bunch of German generals had a secret mission. They were anonymous. They came over to the United States to study the battlefields of the American Civil War. And primarily they were looking at how Stonewall Jackson maneuvered. And supposedly they took those lessons back to Germany and created the Blitzkrieg strategy based on what they learned in their visits to the American South. Unfortunately, there is absolutely not a shred of historical evidence to indicate that ever happened. Yet there are ghost stories. I think one was at an inn where people said they saw the ghost of Rommel. They could smell his pipe smoke. There's another ghost story that occurs in, West Virginia Cemetery, Mount Hebron, I believe, where people have seen this figure, a shadow standing next to the graves of these Confederate generals. And the figure has a field marshal hat on and a long trench coat. And they say that it's, General Rommel. So that was kind of the craziest ghost story for me. And especially when I didn't expect to find Rommel in the United States.
Sure. That wraps up part one of our interview with Matthew Swaney about the ghosts of World War II. In part two of our interview, we're going to talk about what kinds of objects seem to commonly hold spirits, ghosts of World War II. How does society in Europe view the idea of ghosts of World War II as compared to American society. Where do ghosts, tanks, still roam the streets? All these years later, it's something that sometimes people report seeing. Can you imagine that? Also, are there ghost planes? Another one. Heavy machinery. Seemingly ghostly in the sky. Flying above. Not reenactors. Not planes that have been restored, but these are ghost planes. Where are they flying? What are people seeing? Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.